What we take for granted now was a miracle a few centuries ago. Books, printed books, were unknown until the middle of the 15th century. That's when Johann Gutenberg brought several ideas together and made the first practical printing press with movable type. Gutenberg and his team cranked out a number of Bibles, several of which are still extant in the world today. The story of one such book and the people who sought it for their possession is told in a book by Margaret Leslie Davis called The Lost Gutenberg, the astounding story of one book's 500-year odyssey. Margaret Leslie Davis, who prefers Marnie, is the author of several books, including a few works about Los Angeles history, one about Jackie Kennedy and the Mona Lisa, and Dark Side of Fortune, about an oil tycoon. Marnie Davis, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Good morning.
So about that oil tycoon, a quick flip through this book turns up the same last name, Doheny. This is the same couple, isn't it?
Yes, it is. The focus of our Lost Gutenberg is Estelle Doheny, the widow of the great oil tycoon Edward. For a while, he was wealthier than John D. Rockefeller. That kind of gives you a quick snapshot of the amount of wealth he had assumed through his explorations of oil, mainly in the jungles of Mexico.
So Estelle Doheny was doing the book collecting. How rare for a woman in her time to be a book collector?
Astoundingly rare. And because she was a woman, she was really denied access to sort of the book societies, the clubs, the fraternity of the male bibliophiles. But without question, she was the greatest American bibliophile in America of her generation. And she set out for 40 years to acquire the greatest book of them all, the Gutenberg Bible.
Did she have to go through the acquisition process as sort of an unknown player? I mean, given the things that male book collectors wouldn't allow her to do, it sounds like she was probably better off being anonymous.
Well, she almost had to overdo her activities, develop a really cohesive circle of scholars and informed book buyers and book dealers. And in fact, this story touches on some of the greatest book dealers in the world. Her personal book dealer was a man called the Dr. A.S.W. Rosenbach, and he assisted her in her quest to finally, in 1950, purchase the 45th Gutenberg.
Which is where the book begins. Estelle Doheny is taking possession of her Gutenberg Bible. She's 75 years old in 1950, receiving her Gutenberg Bible. And how long had she tried to buy one?
You know, since she heard that tycoon rival, Henry Huntington, had bought his Gutenberg in 1911, she had desired to have a copy of her own. You know, the tycoons, you have all the homes that you'd like and the yachts and beautiful art and beautiful antiques, but also a Gutenberg Bible was a sign of incredible status, incredible esteem that only a handful of individuals in the world could even hope to obtain. The great tragedy was by the time the Gutenberg arrived at her doorstep in October 1950, she was nearly completely blind. So all she could do was touch the leather binding, feel the pages, carry in her arms the heavy book. She was no longer able to read the type.
So Estelle Doheny certainly gave it the proper reverence. She was being very careful with the handling of the book. But in its getting to her, it sounds like this was really nothing special. How was it shipped and handled?
You know, it's amazing. It was sent by a shipping firm, Tyson Lynch. But when it went through customs, it was clumsily handled by the customs broker, despite warnings otherwise. So when it finally did arrive, it was kind of a shabby old mess, newspapers all askew in the box, the strings all a mess. But it did arrive in pretty good shape.
Okay, so it traveled well, which brings us to a question. Marnie, have you seen the Gutenberg 45?
I have only seen it on the internet. This was the very first Gutenberg Bible to be digitized, and today it's locked in a steel vault at Keio University in Tokyo. The fun of this book is I was literally able to trace the footsteps of this book from 1456 to its current home in Tokyo. It's traveled continents, it's traveled through the hands of aristocrats, an earl, a lord, a sauce tycoon, all the way to Estelle Doheny in 1950.
So why is this one called number 45? Because somebody believes it was printed in that order or something?
Yes, There have been many censuses done by scholars of the Gutenberg Bible, and this one is pretty much designated as number 45. So think of this. We are not sure how many Gutenberg Bibles Johann Gutenberg printed, but scholars now think about 180. Could be 200, but certainly 180. And of those 180 copies, 30 were printed on vellum or animal skin. The rest were on parchment. Number 45, for instance, was printed on parchment. But imagine this, to print one copy of the book on animal skin or vellum required 170 calves, the skin of almost 200 animals, to produce one book. I mean, the statistics are astounding. It was about 50,000 sheets of paper. There were 2,500 pieces of type. It's estimated that the Bible took anywhere from 3 to 5 years to produce. It weighed 14 pounds. Today we know of 48 or 49 Gutenberg Bibles that exist around the world today, and of those, 21 are considered complete. Gutenberg printed the Bible in two volumes, Volume 1 and Volume 2, and another interesting detail in our story is Volume 2 has been lost. So if anyone out there can find Volume 2 of number 45, it could be worth as much as $50 million.
$50 million just for Volume 2?
That's right. Scholars today and book dealers estimate that a complete, perfect Gutenberg Bible, meaning it has all its pages, could be worth $100 million. So you figure half of the volume, you know, half of the set, one volume would be $50 million.
Wow. So listen, kids, if you've been poo-pooing the family Bible because you think it's nothing special, you might want to take another look at it. Just, you know, see how old it might be, that
Check
sort of thing.
Check your attic.
Absolutely. The book by Marnie Davis is called The Lost Gutenberg, The Astounding Story of One Book's 500-Year Odyssey. If 50 million doesn't knock your socks off, there's a lot more facts and figures about this book and its owners that might have that effect on you. Back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk more about The Lost Gutenberg with the author and you in a minute 25. On the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're going to read some Bible today. Actually, we're going to talk about some Bible today from another book. The book is The Lost Gutenberg, The Astounding Story of One Book's 500-Year Odyssey. It's the work of Margaret Leslie Davis, the author of Mona Lisa and Camelot and The Dark Side of Fortune. She has been tracing the history of number 45. It is the number 45 Lost Gutenberg. We'll talk about why it's called that in just a moment. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. It's interesting that we're talking about number 45. It reminds me that the president right now is number 45.
Yes.
Take us back to number one. What did Gutenberg do where others had failed, Marnie?
Well, you know, it's hard to believe that in the long 5,000 years of human history that the physical book, the printed, mechanically mass-produced book, was only developed in 1456. And the genius of what Johann Gutenberg did was he assembled sort of aggregated sort of a number of inventions and processes that hadn't been used before and put them all together in sort of a perfectly cohesive system that was really rather accurate. It was almost as if Henry Ford had come up with his assembly line, you know, right out of the gate. The books are still exceedingly beautiful. The ink is known for its sort of lustrous shimmer that still kind of shines on the page. It really is not an exaggeration to state that this single invention, and hence the fruits of this invention, changed the entire course of human history. The Reformation, the scientific revolution, the internet era that we're engaged in today, the digital landscape, is all a direct result of Gutenberg and his invention. Sadly, and many don't know this, Gutenberg ended his life working on the Gutenberg Bibles in bankruptcy. in terrible litigation with his partners and lost his press. So the man who was named by Life magazine the greatest man of the millennium lost it all financially.
Wow, and you know, it sounds like he was fairly humble even before the economic reverses. He didn't toot his own horn very much about his work, did he?
No, and another astounding thing is not a single mark in any of the Gutenberg Bibles identify Johann Gutenberg as the printer. You know, today we're so used to the copyright page with the publisher, an ISBN number, all sorts of dates, all sorts of Library of Congress information or whatever intel related to that particular title. But Gutenberg left no mark of ownership on these books. And in fact, one of the most fascinating things I learned researching this book was the Gutenberg Bible was pretty much a forgotten book for the first 300 years of its existence. You know, today we think of it as the greatest book on earth, you know, like the Hope Diamond, you know, just incredibly famous, the most coveted of all rare books. But it wasn't really until 1763 that the Gutenberg Bible was identified amongst all other books as the first mass produced, mechanically printed book in the West and deserved the ranking of to be above all other books. And it was found in the library of Cardinal Mazarin in Paris by a book authority, a man by the name of de Bure. And since then, Gutenberg's were on the star track.
So the pictures of 45 look beautiful. You mentioned the lustrous ink, and it still looks in fairly good shape. How long? I mean, does the number 45 indicate that this was 45th in a row, or that it was 45th to come off the press?
There was this wonderful woman who cataloged all of the Gutenberg Bibles, and she used all sorts of different layers to come up with her census, and this was number 45. It's impossible to know which one came off the press, but in her census, this was designated as 45. Today, there's for sure 48 known Gutenberg Bibles, and perhaps a 49th, which is by some scholars considered more of a fragment. It's missing a substantial number of its pages. It's called the Rendsburg Fragment. So it's safe to say there's 48 or 49, and this is attributed to Miss Hube is her name, H-U-B-A-Y, a very famous German book scholar.
Is there any one Gutenberg that is complete? No pages missing, and it's got both volumes?
Yes, 21 are considered complete, and in our Library of Congress, we have a very unusual Gutenberg Bible, and it's in three volumes in white pigskin. So it's kind of fun, and imagine that has to exceed the $100 million value.
Truly,
easily.
Truly.
Very rare book.
Margaret Leslie Davis, who goes by Marnie, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Lost Gutenberg, The Astounding Story of One Book's 500-Year Odyssey. Before we talk about the other owners, we've talked about Estelle Doheny a bit already. I want to ask about Rita Falders, who was very important in the life of this book.
Oh, remarkable. She was the curator of number 45 when it was at St. John's Seminary, owned by the Catholic Church. Sadly, the book would be sold later. It's a remarkable turn of events, but we can get into that in a minute. Estelle Doheny coveted this book, unlike the very first owner, who considered it a disappointing old book. And in fact, when he brought it home to his library in 1836, kind of wrapped an old, you know, newspaper and string and shoved it on his shelf, he didn't consider it the most valuable book in his library. To him, his Shakespeare folio was the most important and the most coveted book.
And this is Lord Gosford at Gosford Castle in Northern Ireland. So he's the first owner we're aware of number 45?
That's right. He's the first known modern owner of the Bible. And for your listeners who love Game of Thrones, the great TV series, Gosford Castle is where many of the outdoor scenes from Games of Thrones early in the series were filmed. So you can imagine this colossal castle in Northern Ireland where the third Earl of Gosford stashed his Gutenberg. And really, we're kind of lucky because he tucked it on this top shelf in his library where it was never touched or opened. It was preserved, and I think I credit a lot of this time of no human activity to the great pristine shape that the book is in. The book is really perhaps one of the most beautiful Gutenbergs in existence.
So Gosford was not the most giving of collectors. Is that fair to say?
Yes, he was what we call a point maniac. He was more interested in printing errors, snafus, details. He assiduously opened every book and looked for printer's mistakes or oddities in his books. He didn't revere the Bible, and he certainly didn't revere the Gutenberg Bible. He bought it for only £45 in 1836, which is just a few thousand U.S. dollars in today's valuation. And it's just so ironic that this book that was on his shelf in Gosford Castle turned out to be one of the most valuable books of all time.
Wow, that's amazing. £45. Wow.
A bargain.
Truly. So Lord Gosford died at 57. The collection was sold in 1884. And how much did number 45 go for then?
It went for £600. So quite a leap from £45 to £600. And this time it was purchased by Lord William Amherst. He had been born in 1835. He was really a connoisseur. He had a great aesthetic eye. He had a great love of books and a bottomless hunger for all the world had to offer. And he had an incredible fortune that allowed him to sort of pursue his hobbies, pursue his whims. Imagine now, the Bible now moves to another colossal place. This time it's called Didlington Hall. It's a grand country home, maybe 100 miles north of London in an area called Norfolk. And imagine this house. It reads like a catalog of wealth. It had like 46 bedrooms, one for royalty, visiting royalty, 12 reception rooms, had a grand ballroom. It had a museum that he had filled to the brim with his favorite collection of Egyptian antiquities. And of course, it had a library, a humongous library with a secret vault.
And it sounds like he was quite smitten with his books and took pretty good care of them.
He was an absolute bibliophile, one of the greats in British history. He not only cherished his books, but understood the importance of the Gutenberg Bible. And once he had acquired the Gutenberg Bible, he set out to buy other books in the history of printing to sort of complete a pearl necklace of the history of printing in the West, both in the UK and eventually in America. I love also that he had six daughters. I love a man with six daughters, and they were all really quite a bright, gifted women in their own right who all wrote, had incredible hobbies. They were into gardening. They were into history. As a family, they took many trips to the Middle East, to Egypt, and brought home many incredible antiquities. For those of your listeners who've been to the New York Public, the New York Metropolitan Museum, the giant Egyptian Sekhmet statues, Lord Amherst, I think they weigh like 10 tons, he hauled these statues all the way from Egypt to his country home in Norfolk in the 1880s, and they flanked both sides of the front door. How the heck he ever got 10-ton statues there, I will never know. But it was a fitting spot for the Gutenberg Bible, a book he cherished, a book he adored.
Margaret Leslie Davis's book is about the Gutenberg Bible, number 45. Her book is called The Lost Gutenberg, the astounding story of one book's 500-year odyssey. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions about the Bible and its fate, Gutenberg and his techniques, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I love these little details you've been able to pick up, like how the printing techniques in number 45 appear to change from front of the book to the back.
Yes. You know, this was one of the really fascinating things was part of the journey of number 45 was she underwent scientific testing by nothing less than a cyclotron, what we know sort of in layman's terms as an atom smasher. It was the very same machine that had first isolated plutonium for the atomic bomb. The scientists managed to get permission from the Catholic Church to borrow the book for a few days under intense and hot security, and they tested the book and were really able to determine quite a bit about how the book was printed and the concurrent, meaning what pages of the Bible were printed simultaneously, as it's clear by Gutenberg's production press, that he must have printed multiple units of the Bible concurrently to produce some 180, possibly 200 of these books within this time frame.
So are there features that only 45 has that differ from other Gutenbergs?
Well, you know, the one beautiful part of number 45 is she still contains her original binding. Very few Gutenbergs do. Many books get rebound over the years due to owner's tastes. You know, another interesting detail is when Gutenberg printed the Bible, the buyer was given the Bible in sheets. They weren't bound. It was up to the buyer then to pick sort of a graphic artist, if you will, an illuminator, to draw beautiful illustrations within the Bible, and then the buyer would also select a binder. So he would choose the kind of cover if they wanted a Turkish red leather cover, dark brown if they wanted embellishments. But the beauty of number 45 also is not only this pristine original binding contemporaneous with her printing, which we believe was sometime before 1456, but every beauty has its flaw. And to my knowledge, this is the only Gutenberg that has this sort of a beauty mark, is on the pages. Now, keep in mind, this is the opposite of the spine. The cut pages of the Bible are these sort of ugly vellum, petrified pieces of animal skin. They were like a primitive indexing system for the books of the Bible. So by the time it arrived in Los Angeles in 1950, only three or four of those little vellum markers were still there. Originally, there must have been several dozen of them to mark the books of the Bible. But what's so fun is that in the historic photos, you can immediately identify which Bible is, in fact, number 45, because she is the only one with these little ugly vellum skin tags hanging off her pages.
Marnie, I notice you call the Bible she. This has gotten long beyond an it for you.
It is a she. And the fun thing is, when the scientists were testing her, they started calling her she. They said she was very much like a cat, you know, as they put her in her special cradle, foam rubber holders, you know, tight as this incredible machine came near her to examine the ink and kind of reveal the workshop secrets of Gutenberg's process. The scientists picked up calling her she, and I've taken it on ever since.
Marnie Davis, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book, The Lost Gutenberg, The Astounding Story of One Book's 500-Year Odyssey. We're talking about Gutenberg Bible number 45. So you mentioned that it actually stayed sort of good in neglect by Lord Gosford when he owned it. So has it been damaged or dented other than losing some of those vellum knots over the years?
Not at all. In fact, I think it's possibly one of the best preserved Gutenberg Bibles. You know, another fun detail in this book is, you know, our current dime store novels or a Daniel Steele novel, you know, we know that the pages of that book will decay in about 50 to 75 years. This is a tremendous issue for the Library of Congress to preserve all of these printed books on, you know, cheap modern paper. The Gutenberg was printed on paper imported from Piedmont, Italy. The scholars have actually been able to trace the paper to this one mill in Piedmont, and it was made from cloth or fabric. And it's pretty much been established by book authorities that the pages, the actual parchment pages of a Gutenberg Bible, may last as long as 1,000 years.
Okay, so they got a few hundred left to go.
Exactly.
So a couple of contacts from the audience here. Bill in Arcata wants to know about the pieces of movable type. They have to fit together perfectly and have to be exactly the same length. How did Gutenberg do it, he wants to know.
Well, this is one of the mysteries and miracles that he was able to do this kind of miraculous printing process right out of the gate. Now, is famous as the Gutenberg is, what little we know about the book itself really came from the public record, which is minimal, and from the court cases between Gutenberg and his partners and earlier court cases. So from the court cases, we know he attempted several types of printing. He did a Turkish calendar. He did some indulgences for the Catholic Church. So he had a few warm-ups. But there's no question that this concept of you know, movable, durable type, a series of characters that could be cast in metal, that would be easy to set and reusable. and then learning how to ink them just right with some sort of new rolling device. These were all an aggregation of new techniques and processes that had never been done before.
And for people who aren't familiar with movable type and that, so you're talking about doing this upside down and backwards.
Yes, indeed. It really was a staggering feat. And to think that we know now from the testing on number 45 that these scholars could determine that the Bible was produced in six compositional units that were composed and printed concurrently. So it's almost like you can hear the Gutenberg's press, you know, from the 1450s as he was producing this marvel, this wonder. You know, the most common question I get asked is, gosh, with all this work, this kind of revolutionary, disruptive printing technique, how much did this Bible cost to the buyer? And we know from some of the court records that the Bible was selling for about 30 florins. So what is 30 florins? It's equivalent to, at the time, a clerk's wages for 3 years. So it gives you a quick snapshot of the high dollar value of the Gutenberg, even when it's rolling off the press.
Okay, similar to buying a major appliance or a car in today's world. Yeah, The Lost Gutenberg, The Astounding Story of One Book's 500-Year Odyssey, the book by Margaret Leslie Davis. We'll come back and talk more with Marnie and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about a book today, but we're really talking about two books because book number one is about another book. We're talking to the author of The Lost Gutenberg, The Astounding Story of One Book's 500-Year Odyssey. That's by Margaret Leslie Davis, who goes by Marnie. She's obviously written about Gutenberg Bible number 45, which was in and out of the hands of several owners, including an American one, for several years, starting in 1950. You can join our conversation on the Exchange. Your questions, comments, welcome by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Alice, no town given, has a couple of questions. She wants to know more about vellum because she says it's a paper-like writing surface. You're saying that it is and I've heard this before, it is an animal skin. The other issue that she brings up is she's insisting that the Gutenberg Bible, not the first mass-printed book, that would be the Diamond Sutra, now in the possession of the British Library, printed in 868 in China.
Yes, that is true. It was a Buddhist book from China, dated perhaps 868, that's absolutely right, and it was a method of block printing. However, it wasn't mass-produced, it wasn't mechanically produced, and, of course, the Gutenberg Bible is described as printed in the West. So it's absolutely true. And then also there were some books produced in Korea as well, one known as the Jikji, J-I-K-J-I, and it also had a form of movable type. But again, these were hand-done books. But there's no question that printing originated in the Far East. But in the West, it was the first mass-produced, mechanically produced book.
Now, vellum, how can they get, so this is animal skin, and
yes.
How does it get thin enough to be like paper?
You know, there's a whole process on it, and I really can't speak to the technology of how it's done. But I was just staggered that it would take that many animals, 170 calves, to produce one, you know, complete set of the Gutenberg Bible, two volumes. And the other interesting detail about this is the vellum copies are considered more valuable and worth even more money, and even at the time when the books were sold in the mid-1450s, the vellum copies were considered more pricey, a higher price.
Does the vellum wear better over time than the parchment copies?
Yes, I think so. You know, it is animal skin. You know, we all know, you know, how leather, you know, leather shoes and all the, you know, kind of the animal-based products that have become a very common part of our life. So if the parchment can last 1,000, perhaps the vellum could last even longer.
And Denise, no town given, wants to know what brought you to study the Gutenberg. Your passion is wonderfully clear, she says.
Oh, that's wonderful. I was approached by the woman you mentioned earlier, Rita Falders, who is the curator of the Bible. And she invited me to come and see her materials, which she had rescued from the trash. In the 1987 sale, when the Catholic Church decided to sell Estelle Doheny's Bible, even though she had intended it to stay with the Catholic Church for eternity, for posterity, during the 1987 sale, all the letters, telegrams, diaries, correspondence, and photographs were literally left with the trash. And they were rescued by Miss Rita Falders, who had carefully and painstakingly been the guardian of number 45. She never owned it, but she was its curator. And her love for the Bible just hooked me. She invited me to her home in Camarillo, California, very near the Reagan Library, for your listeners who know California. And I went to see her, and gosh, when she opened her garage door, her garage was lined with boxes, filled to the brim with original documents related to the story. It was like the National Archives. I started going through the boxes and was overcome by the detail and the personal handwritten notes by Estelle Doheny regarding her thoughts and her efforts and the works with the book dealers. And then in the other boxes were items connected to its provenance in its earlier history, in other continents, in previous centuries.
Yeah, I see to this day the Doheny name on philanthropic works in the Los Angeles area. How rich were the Doheny's?
Incredibly wealthy. And another fun detail is, by the time her full book collection was sold, something in the range of $40 million, it actually exceeded the final dollar amount of her husband's oil empire. So it goes to show you that Edward Doheny's fortune, who could fill oil tankers, was almost equivalent to Estelle Doheny's fortune on her million-dollar bookshelf.
Wow. So let's be clear, because Estelle had the book for only 8 years. She only lasted that long after she got it and then died. Mm-hmm. And so the provenance then is where it gets interesting, because you said she willed it to the Catholic Church, but she specified, what, 25 years from her death to the sale of any of her collection?
Unfortunately, there appears to have been a legal loophole in her gift to the Catholic Church that, in my view, was exploited, and sadly, the entire collection was sold. And imagine, her collection not only contained the Gutenberg Bible, but some of the rarest, most important Bibles of all time. She had the Polyglot Bible, you know, very famous for being in four languages. She had the so-called Biblia Pauperum, which was the Pauper's Bible. It was sort of like an early comic book. She had rare Bibles from Fust and Schaefer, the partners of Gutenberg that took over the press. One of my favorite books of hers was a 16th century tiny Book of Hours, sort of a book of prayers. That single book sold at the Christie's auction in 1987 for $1.6 million.
Wow. So let's go back on some of this, because there's a history that comes with the owners of the Bible, where we talked about the fact that Lord Gosford died at 57. Lord Amherst had a reverse that forced him to sell the book.
Yes, he was forced to sort of unload the Gutenberg Bible to climb out of an absolute catastrophic financial disaster, as wealthy as he was. And I can assure you, the lifestyle they led really exceeded even Downton Abbey. That's just to give you a sense of the size of the fortune that Amherst himself had inherited. But his solicitor, a man by the name of Charles Cheston, was found dead in the family's property. He had committed suicide, and only after they discovered his body, they began to unravel that the solicitor had squandered Amherst's fortune, and the Amherst family was nearly bankrupt. So to preserve the family name and honor, Lord Amherst was forced to sell his beloved Gutenberg Bible. And in fact, he died 30 days after the sale.
Ouch.
From a broken heart. His daughter said that often, that her father, having to dispose of his book collection, and especially the Gutenberg, did in fact break his soul.
So let's see if I got my kept my records good here. He bought the book for £600. What did it sell for?
It sold the next time for about £2,050 in 1908 to Dyson Perrins. And some of your listeners might know the famous Worcester sauce, mm-hmm. Perrins, Worcester sauce. He inherited the fortune that derived from this incredibly lucrative sauce empire. And sadly, he too had a reversal of fortune and was forced to sell his, parts of his book collection and the Gutenberg Bible.
And how much did he sell it for?
Well, the next time it sold for 22,000 pounds. So you can see a big jump from 2,000 pounds to 22,000 pounds. And this is our first owner who bought it purely as an investment. His name was Sir Philip Ferrer. He was a well-known London solicitor. His family had had a very famous law firm in London since the 1780s, so quite a history. But he apparently kept it hush-hush that he acquired the Gutenberg, despite, you know, a very tony circle of intellectuals and authors and artists and playwrights and scholars and even book collectors that he socialized with. He apparently never revealed to anyone that he owned the book. And my theory is that he sat on it sort of like we can land bank here in California and in Oregon for incredible leaps in value of property. He sort of Gutenberg banked. He counted on the value of the Gutenberg skyrocketing and that he would make a pretty profit. So of all the owners, he was the only one that looked at it as a complete financial investment.
All right, so he was not a book collector in that sense. He just wanted the money part.
Exactly.
So Estelle Duhini, did she want just that Bible, or would she have gone for any Gutenberg Bible?
You know, over the years, she had tried to bid on other Bibles and had lost. She had tried to buy other Bibles and had lost. But her heart became particularly drawn to this one because it was so unusually beautiful. If your listeners get a chance, Keele University has put every page of the Bible in beautiful high resolution. You can zoom in, you know, see the details. The colors are astounding. Beautiful bluebirds and trumpets and vines of green, gold leaf lettering. And there's fun little mistakes and anomalies in the book, which are really fun to zoom in and kind of see for yourself.
Things where the editors indicated you need to correct this and it never got corrected.
Exactly. It was flagged for correction. Exactly right. Another neat thing is you can actually see the pinholes on the top of the pages where Gutenberg's crew must have put tiny pins to place the paper into the press and then at other times move the pins. So it's kind of fun. It became a parlor game for Amherst earlier with his daughters to kind of look where the pinholes were placed, and they were kind of guessing at the production of the Bible.
We mentioned the fact that things seem to happen to the people who owned Gutenberg number 45. As you put it in the book, ownership requires prepayment and tragedy, and not something that left the Duhinis alone. Although before, I guess, the Bible arrived, the Teapot Dome scandal was a huge deal that overshadowed the administration of President Warren Harding in the United States. How was Edward Duhini involved in that?
Yes, he and his son were indicted for conspiracy and bribery. And the cabinet official that the bribe allegedly was involved in receiving this bribe, his name was Albert Fall. He was a cabinet member. He was Secretary of the Interior. He was found guilty of receiving a bribe that Duhini was found eventually not guilty of giving. So it's one of the greatest twists in American jurisprudence that one man is found guilty of receiving a bribe that another man was found innocent. So this became a big part of Estelle Duhini's book collection, and in fact, her desire to acquire books. It became sort of a form of grief memorialization, a form of family redemption, and in fact, she started her book collection during the trial as a way to take her mind off the fact that Edward Duhini faced the rest of his life in prison.
Well, and Estelle was determined not to have any further reversals of fortune after Edward Duhini died. What did she do with his records?
Well, it's an absolute true story. It's not an urban myth. She went to the basement and burned all of the surviving remnants of Edward Duhini's incredible life and fortune.
So there was going to be no record that would lead to anything that would take away her fortune.
Exactly. No further subpoena, no further scrutiny. And in fact, she enlisted the aid of her sister. They both went down to the giant incinerators. Keep this in mind. This is a huge mansion in Los Angeles, very near the University of Southern California. giant incinerators, and they just loaded boxes and boxes of papers. And of course, at this time, there was no digital record. So it's safe to say she pretty much single-handedly wiped out all written documents related to his estate.
I wonder what Rita Falders, who came so close to the same thing happening to the papers she kept, thought of this.
You know, that's such a good point. There was definitely a real parallel. And I think in this story is a need to right a wrong. The Gutenberg Bible and Estelle Doheny's collection deserve to stay in the West. It was one of the greatest collections of all time in America, certainly, and certainly by a woman collector. When you add the woman part of the story, it is astounding that a self-educated woman was able to amass a book collection of this stature and of this importance.
So let's finish up with where Gutenberg number 45 is now. You said it's in Tokyo in a vault, not on public view?
Yes. In 1987 at the sale, it was October 22, it was purchased for about $5 million with Christie's fee for the auction. It came to a total of $5.4 million, and it was purchased by a publishing firm known as Mazarin, sort of the Simon & Schuster of Japan, a very prestigious, very popular, very successful publishing conglomerate, a real part of the culture and fabric of Tokyo. When it arrived in Japan, you know, many people lined up for blocks to come and see it. Prince Akihito came and donned white gloves to take a look at it. And now it's been donated to the university at Keio University, which is a very prestigious university where it is locked in a steel vault in the library.
Okay, and does not come out to see the light of day.
No.
All right. The Lost Gutenberg, the astounding story of one book's 500-year odyssey by Margaret Leslie Davis. Marnie, thank you so much for sharing your enthusiasm.
Thank you.